sky was churning, but it was neither snowing nor raining when Lucas made it down to City Hall. Dell and Marcy were waiting in the new office. Swanson and Lane are over at the Cheez-It trying to find somebody who might have seen Aronson with Bruce Willis, Marcy said. She handed Lucas a photograph of the actor. We downloaded a picture of Willis from the net, and we're going to have it redrawn and sort of generalized with the long black coat. Put it out in the papers. Lucas snapped the photo with his fingertip. That's good. How about the lists? We got Anderson to set up a computerized sorting program. We type in lists for each woman and push a button and it finds matches. So far we don't have any, but we do have something else. What? We have 9 women calling in saying they got these drawings in the mail. 9? Over 3 years. 5 of them saved the drawings, and 4 of the women are coming in this afternoon to talk to me in Black. We're also getting a little more media space. CNN and Fox picked up on the drawings, and they're showing them every 15 minutes all day. So I can go home and take a nap? No. You and Dell are going to 6 ad agencies. Gonna look in the art department for buzz cut guys with long dark coats. Also, you got a call from a Terry Marshall. He's a sheriff's deputy from over in Menominee, in Wisconsin, Dunn County. He's hot to talk. And a guy named Jerry Hack who wants you to call back right away. Dell said, I got the list of ad agencies. We can walk to them. Let me make the calls and we'll go, Lucas said. He called Hack first. You told those guys who I was, Hack screamed. They're going to kill me. I'm going to lose my job. They're going to pull my nuts off. I didn't tell them anything. They guessed. You've been hanging out with the wrong people. Your speeder friends might pull your nuts off, but these guys, they're not bad guys. They might give you a little shit, but that's about all. God damn it, Davenport! And Jerry, if you call back, make sure you know what you're talking about, okay? This worked out. They even gave me a little help. But bad information is usually worse than no information because we waste time chasing it. Think you can remember that? God damn it! Lucas hung up, looked at the slip for the Dunn County cop, and poked in the number. A woman answered. I'm returning a call from Terry Marshall, Lucas said.
I'm afraid he's gone for the day. Who's calling?
Lucas Davenport. I'm a deputy chief over in Minneapolis.
Oh, Terry's on his way there now. I think he's looking for you.
You know what it's about?
Nope. I just got a note. Says if I need to get him, call your office. He expects to be there by noon unless there's a problem with the snow. He's driving.
There's snow?
Around here there is. It looks like a blizzard. You can see it on the radar all the way to Hudson. Must be past you guys.
Yeah, it's past here. I'll keep an eye out for your guy. He dropped the phone on the hook and went to get Dell. The 6 ad agencies took the rest of the morning. They showed pictures of Willis in Pulp Fiction and got shaking heads. They walked back to City Hall through the skyways, shouldering through the lunchtime rush around the food courts. Lucas got an apple at the courthouse cafeteria and Dell got a tuna fish sandwich. At the office, Marcy was talking to a severe-looking young woman, looked up and said, The Dunn County guy is here. I put him in your office. Terry Marshall was 10 or 15 years older than Lucas, in the indeterminate mid-50s to early 60s, with a lean, weathered face, brown hair showing swatches of gray, and a short, brush-cut mustache. He wore round steel-rimmed glasses that might have made someone else look like John Lennon. Marshall didn't look anything like Lennon. He looked like something that might have eaten Lennon. He was sitting in Lucas's guest chair reading the paper. When Lucas pushed through the door, he stood up.
Your girl out there told me to wait here.
For all his wolfish appearance, he seemed a little embarrassed, and Lucas said, As long as you didn't go through my drawers. Marshall grinned.
Let it never be said that I spent any time in your drawers.
Is that girl a secretary or what? She pushes people around.
She's a cop. She does push.
Ah.
Marshall sat down again.
She seemed like she might be, I don't know, handicapped or something?
We had a guy up here running around shooting people last fall. We caught him in a gas station. It was on TV.
Now I remember that.
Before we caught him, the guy shot Marcy with a hunting rifle. She got off a couple of rounds when she was down, helped us pin down the car and break the whole thing, but she was pretty messed up.
Jeez, she gonna be all right?
There was concern in his voice,
and Lucas liked him for it. In a while, she's getting pretty antsy already, that's why we've got her in here. So, what can I do for you?
Yeah.
Marshall had a beat-up leather briefcase by his foot, and he picked it up, dug through it, and pulled out a legal portfolio.
This file is for you. 9 years ago, we had a young girl, 19, disappear. Name was Laura Winton. We never found out what happened to her, but we think she was strangled or smothered and dumped out in the country somewhere. We never did find the guy who did it.
You think?
The thing is, he was pretty clever. He apparently hung around this girl for a week before he killed her. He killed her on Christmas Day, during Christmas break at the university. She lived on a street full of older houses that are all cut up into apartments as off-campus student housing. You know what they're like.
Yeah, I know. I lived in the same kind of place myself when I was a kid.
Marshall nodded. Anyway, he hung around her for about a week, and not a single one of her housemates ever saw him. When he killed her, he did it when they were all gone for Christmas.
Why wasn't she gone?
Because she was a hometown girl. She was the older of two daughters, and she had two younger brothers. And when she moved out of her house to go to the university, the other daughter got the bedroom to herself. It was just too much trouble to stay overnight when her own place was only a couple of miles away. So she went over to her parents for Christmas morning to open gifts and eat lunch, and then she went back to her apartment. As far as we know, nobody ever saw her again, except the killer.
Why do you think she was strangled?
We brought in a crime scene crew. There was nothing obvious, no big pools of blood or anything, no sign of violence, except she had this old fake Oriental rug. They found her fingernails in it.
Fingernails?
3 of them. She was trying to pull herself away from somebody, clawing across this rug, snapped her fingernails off. There was a little fresh blood on one of them, and we type-matched it. It was hers.
Lucas thought about it for a minute.
I can see that, a strangulation.
Marshall nodded.
And she was going with a guy her housemates called the artist.
Lucas leaned forward.
The artist?
Yeah.
He met her at the union, sort of picked her up. He told her he was an art student, and then his name was Tom Lang or Tom Lane. She went out to meet the guy a couple of times, and her housemates had teased her about him. What he looked like, was he ugly, and so on. She said he was cute, blonde, skinny, not very tall. She told one of the girls that he looked like a movie star.
Not Bruce Willis.
Marshall, puzzled, shook his head. No, no. Like a guy named Edward Fox. He played the bad guy in a movie called Day of the Jackal.
The assassin? The guy trying to kill Charles de Gaulle?
That's the guy. I seen the picture about 100 times.
He never drew a picture of her or anything?
Not that we know of.
Any forensics at all?
No. Not except for the fingernails.
Marshall was floundering, and Lucas looked at him curiously.
Did you know this girl?
Yeah. Yeah. She was my niece. My sister's girl. She was like a daughter. I never had a kid, and I just...
Geez, I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, I just hope I haven't gone goofy. When I saw that thing on TV last night, there wasn't one thing that didn't sound like our guy.
Lucas leaned back in his chair. I hate to tell you this, but we found a guy last night who might have seen him. He supposedly looks like Bruce Willis. Kind of stocky, buzz-cut hair, dark. We do think he might have met Aronson in a restaurant, like the guy picking up your niece in the union. Hang on a second. He went to the outer office and retrieved Marcy's generalized drawing of Willis, brought it back, and passed it to Marshall. We found an old friend of Aronson's last night who might have seen the guy, just by accident. This is what we think he might look like.
Marshall looked at the picture for a moment, shook his head. Just the opposite of what Laura told her housemates. Perfect opposite.
Pretty much, Lucas said.
Marshall sighed. Maybe I'm on the wrong track. But there are a couple of other things in the file. I've kept a lookout for women who might have been victims. There was a young girl here in Minnesota who disappeared about 2 years ago after Laura was killed. Linda Kyle came from Albert Lea
and was going to Carleton College in Northfield. Anyway, she disappeared, never has been found. She was an art student and had been hanging around galleries up here in Minneapolis. She had a couple of dates with a guy in the city, but none of her friends ever saw him. No suspects.
None of her friends ever saw him. It's like a technique. I don't remember her. I don't remember the case.
Not too surprising. 7 years ago, and they never found anything. And then there's another one. 3 years ago, from New Richmond, Wisconsin, a woman named Nancy Vanderpost. Married, but separated, 22 years old, and one day she disappeared. Hasn't been found. She'd been talking about going to Los Angeles and doing performance art. She also had a romance going on here in the Twin Cities, but they never identified the guy. She was living in a trailer home, and when they went in, there was no sign of a struggle or anything, but they found fingernails. Two broken fingernails. And they found her purse next to a couch. All of her clothes were there, as far as they knew. And the main thing is, all of her insulin was there. She wouldn't have left that. The connection is the fingernails and the art in the cities, Lucas asked. And the thing about nobody ever seeing who the woman is dating. Marshall nodded. One other thing, a guess. All the trailers in this trailer court are 10 feet apart. If her purse was in the place, then I think that's where the guy took her out of. He didn't shoot her. Didn't beat her to death. Didn't do anything that gave her a chance to scream. I think he strangled her. I think that's what the fingernails mean. These women are beating their hands on the floor. No drawings? Only hers. She did drawing and music and dance and acting, but I'm told she wasn't very good at any of it. Just sort of a fucked up soul looking for something a little bigger than she was. Some kind of art guy. That's what I think, Marshall said. I pushed it hard as I could, but there was nothing to go on, and there was always the possibility that she was in L.A. Her car was parked in town.
I see one difference between what you've got and what we've got. Yours are all small-town kids, and ours isn't. Aronson was living here in the cities and had been, but the papers said she was originally small-town. Maybe it's an attitude that pulls him in.
Maybe. Lucas got his feet up on his desk.
You heading back home?
I'd like to hang around this afternoon. It was snowing like crazy when I went through Hudson, and I'm afraid they're going to close the interstate over the river. I'd like to see what you got going. I know our part of the case backwards and forwards, and maybe something will occur to me.
Hey, you're welcome to hang out as long as you want. Get Marcy to run that name, Tom Lang, through the lists we're compiling. Maybe you should go over and look at Aronson's body. Talk to the docs. See if she's missing any nails.
Dell came back a few minutes later after Marshall left and found Lucas staring at the ceiling of his office.
Hey, what's up?
Huh? Looks like you've seen a ghost.
Lucas explained about Marshall.
I've been looking through his file. It's got a bad feel to it, Dell.
You think he's onto something?
I'm afraid he might be. Lucas pushed himself onto his feet.
Let's go look up Morris Ware.
Dell nodded. That dickhead. I was hoping he'd move to one of the fucking coasts with the rest of the perverts.
He's back out on the street with his brownie looking for the young stuff again.
Not surprised. That's not something you get over.
Didn't Ware run with the art crowd? Like from over at the Walker?
Yeah, for a while. He did this book, Little Women on the Edge, or something like that. Like on the edge of puberty. It was supposed to be art, but it had the smell of puke about it.
Morris Ware's office was in a long line of low, yellow-painted concrete block warehouse spaces that mostly held distributors of one kind or another. They finally spotted it between a pressure hose distributor and something called Christmas Inc. The warehouse was fronted by a service street with diagonal parking. Lucas pulled in 50 feet past Ware's, and they both got out. As they did, a woman pulled in at Christmas Inc., walked around to the back of her minivan, and popped the hatch. She was struggling with a cardboard box when Lucas and Dell walked up.
"Let me get that for you," Lucas said.
She stepped back.
"Thanks."
The woman was in her 50s,
with elaborate gold-frosted hair and electric red lipstick. She wore a hip-length nylon parka. She waited until Lucas had the box out, locked the van, and led the way to the door of Christmas Inc. Inside, a counter ran from wall to wall, and another woman and two men sat at metal desks in the back, peering at computer screens. One wall was covered with holiday cards. The woman in the parka lifted a countertop gate, went through, and said, "You can just leave it on the counter. Thanks again." Lucas put the box on the counter. "We're Minneapolis police." The three people in the back all looked up. "We're looking for a guy named Morris Ware." One of the men looked at the woman behind the computer screen and said, "Told you." The woman in the parka said, "There's some pretty peculiar goings-on over there." Dell asked, "Like what?" One of the men said, "I was out back hauling some trash to the dumpster. This kid who works over there was hauling out some bags of trash. When he went back in, I caught a shot of this girl. She was naked."
"How old?" Lucas asked.
The guy shrugged.
"Not very."
"Younger than 18?
15 at the most.
"Please don't mention this to anyone, okay? And thanks. Dell, let's go outside." Outside, they walked back toward Lucas's car.
"We can call Benton. He'd give us a warrant."
"Take an hour," Dell said. "So we go and eat some black beans and rice."
"He won't talk. Ware'll get lawyers and they'll shut him up."
Lucas thought about it for a minute. "Aronson isn't coming back to life. And if Ware's doing that child shit, we ought to put him in Stillwater regardless of Aronson. We can have the sex guys find us somebody else who knows the city."
Dell nodded.
"All right, let's go for the warrant." They spent an hour at a health food place in Roseville eating black beans with cheese, waiting for the phone call. They got it, and just before 4 o'clock, a Chevy van with the entry team backed into a parking space between Christmas Inc. and Ware's office, while two squads moved into position to block the back door. Lucas and Dell watched the van unload. Carolyn Ree, the sex unit cop, led the way in her leather jacket. A uniformed cop followed just behind, carrying a sledge. Another uniformed cop and a computer specialist climbed out behind them. Ree tried the door handle, shook her head, no, stepped aside, and the uniformed cop lifted the sledge. As the door exploded inward, Lucas and Dell joined the surge into the office. The front was exactly that, a front. Only 7 or 8 feet deep, it contained 4 chairs and a metal desk with a red telephone. A door, closed, led into the back. The uniformed cop didn't bother to try the knob, but simply kicked it, and the door flew open. The back room was huge, a warehouse space draped with rolls of backdrop paper. A plush red couch was sitting on one of the rolls. A brass bedstead with a king-sized mattress was pushed into a corner. A short, balding man sat on the couch, holding a camera. He was frozen in place. Another man, older, taller, wearing a crisp white shirt and gray slacks, was walking briskly toward a desk full of computer equipment. The computer cop yelled, "Hey, hey, hey!" And the man walked faster, reaching, and the computer cop ran straight into him and pushed him away from the desk. Another man, who had been out of sight behind a lighting rack, walked to the back door and punched it open. 2 cops stood there and he turned back. "Hey, what's happening?" Then the guy on the couch with the camera stood up and said, "I'm leaving. I'm not even supposed to be here."
"Everybody shut up," Ree shouted. "We're Minneapolis police."
"I want to call my lawyer,"
the man in the white shirt shouted. Lucas walked over to him.
"How are you, Morris? You remember me?"
"No, I don't. I want my attorney, and I want him now."
"Somebody give Mr. Ware a copy of the warrant, then take him out front and let him use the phone." Ree got IDs on the 2 other men, Donald Henry and Anthony Carr, as Ware was taken into the front room. The computer specialist pulled a phone line out of the back of Ware's sleek Macintosh and checked the power cords that went out to peripherals. "Looks okay. We're isolated, but I'd rather not work on it until I can get it back to the shop." Lucas nodded. "Whatever's best. The way he was going for it when we came in, gotta be something there." One uniformed cop from the blocking squad watched the 2 men on the couch, while Ree, Larson, Dell, Lucas, and the two entry team uniforms began pulling the back room apart. They found not a single photograph. They did find 24 jazz discs for the Macintosh. Finally, Lucas asked Henry, the man with the camera, "What are we going to find on the discs?"
"I don't know. I'm just hired to shoot. Nothing illegal. I wouldn't shoot anything illegal."
"Does anything illegal get shot in here?"
"I don't know. I was just hired for one shoot."
"When?" Henry looked at his watch.
"Half hour?"
Lucas turned to Ree. "Maybe we ought to get Ware back in here. You could sit out front and be a receptionist." She ticked a finger at him.
"Not bad."
Ware came back with his escort. "Sit on the couch." Lucas crooked a finger at the man with the camera, who followed him into the front room. Ree was moving a chair behind the metal desk, ready to receive visitors. To Henry, Lucas said, "If we find child porn on those discs, child stuff is Ware's big thing, then you could wind up in Stillwater for a few years."
"Listen, man, honest to God, I was hired."
"We understand that, and we'll take into account any help you give us."
"I gotta talk to a lawyer.
Just give me one thing. We might not need you an hour from now."
"I'm not a bad guy. I'm just trying to make a living. I usually do wildlife and nature."
"Yeah, well, that's cool." Henry sat head down for a moment, then,
"I don't know about the child porn thing. I heard that he does it, but it'd be stupid. It's death. There are plenty of places outside the states where you can do it all you want and nobody cares."
"Ware is sort of a hands-on kind of guy," Lucas said. The photographer winced.
"Just one thing?"
"Just one."
He nodded. "But you gotta help me. The thing is, sometimes when I've been here, the actors sort of like to get their noses into it, and Maury usually has a little coke around. I've seen him get it a couple of times. I think one of the power outlets behind his desk is a fake. I think he keeps a little stash in there."
Lucas slapped him on the back. "See? That was no problem. And if you're like an up-and-up nature guy, like you say, maybe we can deal. Okay? Now, I'm going to put you back on the couch with Ware. Don't say anything to him." Lucas brought Dell out to the front, told him about the power outlets, then sent Henry back to the couch and brought Carr into the outer room. Lucas made the same pitch.
"Look, all I do is maintain his website," Carr said. "He puts his pictures on discs, gives me the index number, and I move them over to the web and set up thumbnails. ErosFineArtPhotos.com.
"Any children on the site?"
Carr looked uncomfortable. "I don't know. I don't see everything. I just move megabytes. I'm a moving guy."
Lucas nodded. "Listen, pal, you better get an attorney. If we find pictures of kids, you're going to go down as an accomplice. You better think of ways to help us."
Carr audibly exhaled. "Maury once told me that sometimes he had special stuff."
"Special stuff?"
"That's what he called it. He said he'd transfer it directly to a guy in Europe who puts it up on a website there. I think Maury's a content provider. We got 8 zillion websites without content, and Maury provides it."
"There's not enough porno out there?" Ree asked.
"Yeah, there's a lot of stuff, but people are always looking for fresh stuff."
"Young stuff," Ree said.
"Yeah, teenagers, anyway."
"I'll make you a deal right now," Lucas said. "Give me something, and I'll help you out. I won't help you if I find out you've been dealing kid stuff, but if you're just getting paid by Ware to run his website, we can help." Carr rubbed his hair.
"There's a possibility that he ships stuff to an underground website in Europe. Holland, I think. Called Donner Blitzen 451. You need some kind of code to get in. Putting in the wrong code too many times may wipe the site. Maybe your guys can do something with it."
"Donner Blitzen? Like the reindeer?"
"Yeah.
451, like the Ray Bradbury book, Fahrenheit 451. 451 is supposed to be the burning point of paper, so I think that's Maury's little joke. If you put the wrong number into the website, more than a couple of times anyway, it burns. It's his warehouse, I think. You put a high-res photo file in there, somebody wants something special, you go to your warehouse, you order it sent, the site sends out the file, the recipient prints it. There's no way to get back to Maury. He has a photo negative for 10 minutes. After he develops it, he scans it, he burns the neg, and the picture is nothing but a bunch of numbers somewhere in Europe. That's interesting. But you don't know the code to get in?
No, but I've seen the setup before, and I think it's booby-trapped.
When Lucas was done with Carr, he sent him back to the couch and said to Ree, "We need to get the code for that website before we turn Ware loose. If he gets 5 minutes with a computer, he can kill the site."
"How are we going to do that?"
"Call the feds, I guess. They're supposed to have some big-deal computer forensics operation going on, and..." He turned his head at movement outside. "Hey, I think we got customers." A man and a woman had gotten out of an old Chevy and were walking toward the door.
"They'll see the broken door," Ree said.
"I'll get it." Lucas hurried over to the door and pulled it open, as though he were leaving. The man was just stepping up on the sidewalk.
"Hey, is Maury around?"
"Yeah, he's in the back. Who are you?"
"We're the talent," the woman said.
She was young, but her face was tough.
"Come on in, talk to Carolyn," Lucas said.
The two stepped past Lucas. The woman said to Ree,
"We're the talent. We're a couple of minutes early."
"That's all right." Ree held up her badge. "We're the police. Maury's being raided." The woman said,
"Oh, shit. We haven't done anything."
"No, but we're asking people to cooperate. I'd like to see a little ID, a driver's license."
"I don't drive."
"Oh, horse shit," Lucas said to Ree. "Get a juvie officer down here." The man said, "What about me?" "You better sit down. I got a whole bunch of bad news for you." 10 minutes later, Lucas arrested Ware on charges of abusing a minor and of creating child pornography, and Henry for creating child pornography. The young woman said he was the shooter at the last session, and he nailed the man who arrived with her for child sexual abuse. Carr was freed, but told not to leave Minnesota.
"She's not a child," Ware snarled. "Looks like a kid after you scrape off the abuse," Dell said.
To Lucas,
"I was fooling around behind the desk, and one of those power outlets looked a little strange. I took the cover off, and guess what? It's a little teeny little safe. There's a baggie full of white powder inside. We gotta get the crime scene folks down here."
Lucas looked at Ware. Uh-oh. The uniformed cops took Ware downtown to be booked, and Lucas called Washington from his cell phone. He finally tracked down Lewis Mallard at his home.
"We need another favor."
"Geez, you guys are running up a bill," Mallard said.
"Well, you know, we're tracking this guy, the drawing guy."
"Yeah, yeah, quite the artworks."
"So we went out and busted a porno guy, hoping we can squeeze him on the sex scene around here. And we find out that he's probably got a child sex photo warehouse over in Europe somewhere. Our source gave us the address for the site, but says the thing can probably be burned in about 10 seconds. We need some hot shit feds to track the site down, then maybe get onto the cops wherever it is. Our source thinks maybe Holland, and grab the servers before our man makes bail tomorrow."
"We can try," Mallard said. "We're fairly tight with the Dutch."
Lucas gave Mallard the details.
"I'll call you tomorrow, and we ought to have something on the drawings tomorrow morning."
Later that night, Lucas and Weather walked down to Eau du Chien, a new French-American restaurant in St. Paul. They ordered Chardonnay and looked at the menus, and Weather asked, without taking her eyes off the menu,
"Whatever happened to that engagement ring?"
"Gave it away."
Now she looked up.
"Gave it away?"
"For charity. I got a tax write-off."
"Lucas, this is serious. If you're pulling my leg, it's in the chest of drawers, second drawer, in the box under my socks. I've been thinking, we may be going at this whole thing a little too informally."
"You're scaring me."
"I don't want to scare you. I just think we should talk."
"Ah, Jesus, not that."
"What?"
"Talk. I don't want to talk with a capital T. I want to get married and have a couple of kids and send them to parochial schools or wherever you think is best, but I really don't want to fucking hack through all the pieces ahead of time."
"I don't want to hack through all the pieces. I just want to have some kind of rational discussion. I mean, we haven't even formally decided to get married yet."
"Whether will you marry me?"
"That's not what I was looking for exactly."
"Well, will you?"
"Well, yes."
"Good.
That's taken care of.
Put the ring on, and tell me what the fuck number 5 is,
That's not something with snails or clams, is it? Lucas! Weather, I'm begging you. Not right now. Not in Eau du Chien. We can go home, have a beer, get comfortable. You'll wave your arms around and rave. I will not. You won't if we talk here. God damn it, Weather. The waiter thought they were having a fight. Lucas arrived at the office at 9 o'clock, ragged after a long, intense evening. Marcy was shouting at somebody on the telephone. A bullet-headed man sat in a chair next to her desk, watching her talk. When she saw Lucas walk in, she shouted, "Gotta go!" hung up and said, "You know the guy with the butch haircut and the long black coat who was seen with Aronson outside of Cheez-It?" "Yeah." "This is the guy. Jim Wise. Walked in a half hour ago." Wise stood up, and Lucas noticed that he had a black coat folded over his arm. "I saw the picture in the paper and thought it had to be me. I was in there with her, and I had the coat, and my hair used to be cut shorter." "Put the coat on," Marcy said. Wise pulled the coat on and looked at Lucas. "Damn it. How well do you know her?" "Not very well. I've got a furniture business. Ms. Aronson did freelance ad work, and we needed some good-looking ads cheap, and that's what I was seeing her about."
"Did she do the ads?"
"Yeah, 3 of them. They're still running."
"Did you see her more than the one time?"
"Yeah, when she delivered them."
"Why'd you meet at Cheez-It? She lived downtown here."
"She worked there. She was upfront about it. She was working until she got her feet in the ground and suggested that I just stop in when I had a minute and we'd talk. We wound up walking down to a coffee bar so I could sketch out what we wanted." They talked for another 3 minutes, and Lucas was convinced. Not only was he probably the right guy, he probably had nothing to do with the killing. "I've got a guy I want you to talk to if you have a few minutes. Give a statement," he told Wise.
"You think I'm okay? The whole thing was quite a shock, seeing the picture in the paper."
"We'll pull the picture. We'll say that you came forward voluntarily and whatever sounds good." Lucas called Sloan, who was the best interrogator on the force. Sloan took Wise off to homicide to make the statement. Lucas looked at Marcy.
"Shoots that idea in the ass."
"Not only that, wait till you hear what the feds have for us."
"Good news or bad?"
"One of each. Which do you want first?"
"Bad."
"You know that profiling stuff on the drawings? It's shit. You could get it out of a book. He's probably between 25 and 40 and has some formal education in the arts."
"Oh, man.
What's the good news?" "The Dutch cops grabbed Ware's computer site in Holland. They say there are huge files that gotta be pictures. Hundreds of them."
"Has Ware made bail yet?"
"Hearings right now."
"Who's his attorney?"
"Jeff Baxter."
"All right. I'll walk on over there and see if I can catch him."
"Too bad about the drawings."
"Yeah."
Lucas pulled at his lip for a moment. "There's an art guy over in St. Paul, supposed to be a big name. He's a painter. I don't know anything about him except that I called him one time. There was a question about a painting, and he just told me the right answer off the top of his head. A guy over at the U says he's a genius. Maybe if we asked him to take a look."
"What's his name?"
Lucas scratched his head.
Kid. Can't remember his first name.
"I'll run him down. What are you doing the rest of the day?"
"Talk to Baxter and Ware. Read all the papers."
"God damn it. I wish Wise had run for the border instead of coming here. We would have had him in a day."
"Two problems. He wasn't there, and he didn't do it."
"Yeah, yeah. But you know what this does? That guy from Menominee? This puts his whole theory back in play. A skinny blonde guy who looks like some other movie star, not Bruce Willis."
"Edward Fox. The guy in Day of the Jackal."
"Yeah.
I'm gonna have to look at it again, get a feel for the guy."
Jeff Baxter, a 30-something criminal attorney with reddish-blonde hair, was leaning against a wall outside a courtroom. He saw Lucas coming and raised a hand.
"Is this just a random friendly encounter, or did you come over looking for me?"
"You're defending Maury Ware?"
"Yeah. Your guys just finished throwing the book at him. I'm not sure how good a case it is."
Baxter was a good attorney and could smell the smallest molecules of a possible deal. However good it is, it got better in the last couple hours. The Dutch cops grabbed Ware's website in Holland, and I suspect it's chock full of little children playing with their wee-wees. Ah, fuck. You know for sure they're kids? Not yet, but Maury's a scuzzbag, whatever they find. Yeah, well, just between you and me, if I ever caught him standing next to one of my kids, I'd stick a gun in his ear. But he does get a lawyer. That's why I'm talking to you. Ware may be able to help us on another unrelated case, and we can probably deal down the cocaine problem. What other case? The Aronson murder. The guy in the black coat? I saw his picture. Wasn't him. He came in this morning. Anyway, we need to talk to Ware about what he knows about sex freaks in the art community. Since he is one, we thought he might know some more. You don't think he's involved? Lucas shook his head. No reason to think so. So I'll talk to Maury. Baxter looked at his watch. He's downstairs getting his clothes. They chatted for another minute, then Lucas headed back to his office. Marcy said, I talked to that artist. He said he could stop by this afternoon. Excellent. What are you doing? Just gonna wait for Ware? Yeah, and read the file that the Menominee guy brought in. Maybe there's something in it. Going through the file, Lucas began making a list. The three missing women all had several things in common with Aronson. They were all blondes, all in their 20s, and all three had some involvement with art. And specifically, he decided, painting. All three in the Menominee files had taken art classes shortly before their deaths. There were no classes listed in Aronson's file, but since she was young and in the arts, she almost certainly had taken some. All of them, he thought, either lived in or recently had lived in small towns. But the small towns were scattered all over the place and might not mean anything except that small town women were a little more vulnerable than big city kids. His list. Look at art teachers at the schools they attended. Check for criminal records involving sex. If the teachers don't pan out, get class lists and look at students. Go back 10 years. Look for small blondes reported as missing anywhere in southeastern Minnesota or western Wisconsin. What about the drawings? The guy who killed Aronson, if he was the same guy who did the drawings, seemed to be under some compulsion to draw the women. There were no drawings listed in the Menominee files, but that didn't mean there weren't any. He may have retrieved them after he killed the women. He was still going through the file page by page when Marcy stuck her head in the door. Ware's attorney called. They don't want to talk until they get the deal on paper from the county attorney. That's going on now, and they'll be over as soon as they're done. All right. He went back to the file, and when he looked up again, out through the office window, he saw Marcy talking to a man in a scarlet ski jacket and faded jeans. The man had broad shoulders, like a gymnast's, and a nose that looked like it had been hit once or twice too often. Lucas recognized him from somewhere, a long time ago. He walked over to the door. "This is Mr. Kidd," Marcy said. "I was just coming to get you." "Yeah, I saw you dashing from my door." Lucas and Kidd shook hands, and Lucas said, "I know you from somewhere, a long time ago." Kidd nodded. "We were at the university at the same time. You were a hockey jock." Lucas snapped his fingers. "You were the wrestler." "Marcy told me about the drawings. We were just going to take a look." Kidd handled the drawings carefully, Lucas noticed, like real artworks. "What do you think?" "He's a porno freak." "That's a keen observation," Marcy said. "I'll write that down in my big book of clues." "I mean a photo porno freak," Kidd said. "Most of these bodies were drawn from pornographic photographs, and the heads were added later. It'd be no problem with a computer program like Photoshop. Kids do it all the time. Take the head off a movie star and stick it with a piece of porn and try to pass it off as a real photograph. I think the guy never really saw these women nude." "So he's a photographer?" Marcy asked. "I think he's an artist, but he's using photography. A straight photographer wouldn't draw this well," Kidd said. "How hard would it be?" "Not hard. You can take a photograph of somebody, scan it, find a porno shot on the net, and match them.
Then you can eliminate the photographic detail using a Photoshop filter and produce something that almost looks like a drawing. Then you can project that image on a piece of paper and draw over the projected image. It takes some skill. This guy has had some training, I think. The woman who was killed did commercial art and design, ads and stuff, Marcy said. We thought maybe somebody she met in the business. Kid shook his head. I don't think he's a commercial artist. Commercial artists learn a lot of shortcuts. They're not struggling to get down something that's unique. These drawings look like the guy was trying pretty hard. So, an artist. Not a very good one, Kid said. Jeff Baxter stepped into the office. Morris Ware trailed behind, looking stunned. Lucas looked past Kid and said, This is the right place. Why don't you just go into my office right in there? We'll just be a minute. Kid was collecting his jacket, and Lucas said, Thanks for coming. You told us more about the killer in 10 minutes than the feds did in 2 days. Yet another reason to eat the FBI, Kid said. And to Marcy, Speaking of eating, isn't there a cafeteria around here someplace? I don't know Minneapolis very well. I could probably show you a better place. That'd be good. Huh. The guy comes over to catch a killer and winds up hustling my staff, Lucas said, bending his head back to talk to the ceiling. With a staff like this, Kid said. Yeah. Kid and Marcy left together. Kid was asking, Can I touch your gun? And Lucas, shaking his head at the ways of single sex, called Sloan and asked him to come over. Sloan was a narrow-faced man who tended to dress in shades of gray and brown. He was one of Lucas's best friends, and for years had never seemed to change. But Lucas had noticed in the past few months that Sloan's hair was swiftly going white. The last time they'd talked, Sloan had remarked that he'd be eligible to retire in a couple of years. Getting old. Sloan banged into the office and asked cheerfully, Everybody ready? Lucas nodded, and Sloan plugged in the tape deck, and then recited everybody's names and the date. Morris Ware listened to the story of the drawings, then looked at the drawings. Very nice, he said with a bored tone. What? Lucas asked. They're not to your taste? No, they are not. You like the young stuff, Lucas suggested. I'm not interested in bodies. I am interested in qualities. Innocence, freshness, dawning awareness. Let's cut the horse shit, Maury. Look at this guy. Ware took the printed out photo of the actor from Day of the Jackal. Yes? Who do you know in the sex freak community who looks like this? A guy with connection to the arts, who knows about computers and photography, is interested in blonde women, who might like to strangle him, huh? You know, this is a fashionable look among the art crowd. That languid, ascot-wearing private school look. Ware closed his eyes and tilted his head back. I think I met your man at a photography show at the Institute. But it was a long time ago, 10 years maybe. The fellow was maybe 25, and he was looking at a series of nudes by Edward Weston. I can sometimes tell by the way people look at pictures that they're enthusiasts. He had the look. And by the way, he doesn't much look like the man in your photograph, as much as he shares an air with him. What'd he say? He talked about how Weston did photographs that were as clean as fine drawings. He took a pencil from his pocket and used the eraser end to show you how you could follow the line in the nude to make a whole new creation. There was a certain frenzy to it. Sloan glanced at Lucas, then at Ware. That's interesting. Do you remember his name or what he does? Ware opened his eyes and looked at Lucas. I never knew his name. I can't remember seeing him since that day. But one thing struck me, given his enthusiasm. I don't know what it was, but something he said made me think that he was a priest, or studying to be a priest, or something. Really? Sloan's eyebrows went up. He was wearing a collar? No, nothing like that. But if you were a priest and you were going to an exhibit of nudes, maybe you wouldn't wear the collar. One other thing. He was so obviously an enthusiast, and perhaps he saw it in me, that we walked along for a bit, looking at the photographs, and I said something about women being endlessly fascinating. He shook his head and he said, Not endlessly. Not endlessly.
He looked at me and I was a little frightened. Really, frightened.
Lucas said, huh. In the middle of the day in the museum, you were frightened.
Yeah.
Ware nodded.
Years ago, back in the 80s, there were rumors of Mexican snuff flicks. You know, some woman gets hauled into a warehouse, is raped and beaten, and then she's killed on camera. Occasionally, you get somebody looking for one. Sometimes they were cops, sometimes they were reporters. Sometimes they were people who scared you. People who really wanted a snuff flick. I got a whiff of that from the priest.
But you don't really know that he was a priest.
Something he said.
Have you ever seen anything like these drawings on the internet?
Not really. Porn guys like photographs. They like specifics. You show them a clitoris the size of a chili pepper, they want you to blow it up as big as a zucchini. And they always want better color and better resolution. They're crazy.
Have you seen photographs that look like the bodies in these drawings?
Well, sure, the drawings, those are all pretty standard poses.
I mean specifically, photos that could have been used for these drawings. Ware shook his head.
I couldn't tell you that. I'm not out on the internet that much. You ought to ask Tony Carr.
Carr was the computer tech who'd been at Ware's. What about him? Sloan asked.
He knows all the sites.
How about Henry? Lucas asked.
He's just a hired gun. He's a dummy.
Marcy had returned during the interrogation and was at her desk when Lucas and Sloan finished with Ware. Get anything? We need to talk to Anthony Carr again. Call him up and tell him to come in. How was your lunch with Kid?
He's a pretty good guy.
He's supposed to be a good painter.
I called up a woman I know over at the Institute. She said Kid paints 6 or 8 paintings a year and gets maybe $50,000 each. He's in all the big museums.
Huh. You gonna see him again?
I wouldn't be surprised. He kinda liked me.
Did you let him touch your gun?
Not yet.
Lucas took the Menominee files home with him. Weather arrived a few minutes after he did and they ate. Weather helped him with the dishes, and afterwards Lucas went back to the file for Menominee. At the back, there were Xerox copies of perhaps 30 or 40 photographs. Most of them were police photos taken in Laura Winton's apartment or in Nancy Vanderpost's trailer home by crime scene crews. One set was mostly of a young woman, identified in notes as Winton, Marshall's niece. She was shown walking in the woods and then standing on a sidewalk somewhere. There was a gap in the trees behind her, and Lucas thought it looked a lot like the Mississippi River Valley between Minneapolis and St. Paul, but there were no identifying landmarks, only a small semicircular stone wall. He handed the photo to Weather.
Think that's around here?
Could be. Who is it? He explained, and she said, then it might be in Menominee. There's a river and a big lake there, pretty deep valley, could be there.
Feels like here.
He had to page back through the file to find the spot where he'd taken the photo out, and there was something about the pictures in the woods. Were they close by? Maybe they went with the stone wall photo, something that he walked by often enough to ring a bell. Then he tumbled.
Holy shit!
Weather looked up.
What?
These pictures. They look like the place where Aronson's body was found.
What?
These pictures of Winton. They look like they're taken where Aronson was found. I went down there the other day. He went through them again.
God damn it, Weather. I think it's the same place.
Marshall might know something. Lucas looked at his watch. 11:20. Still early enough. He found Marshall's business card with a home phone number scrawled on the back. He dialed and the phone rang.
Hello?
Terry Marshall?
Yeah, who's this?
Terry, I apologize for calling you at this time of night. But this is Lucas Davenport, the deputy chief you talked to?
Yeah, chief. What's going on?
I've been reading your files, looking at those pictures of your niece in the woods. Where'd those come from?
The pictures. We think, I think, that they might have been taken by the killer. When she came up missing and the story got in the papers, the owner of a local drugstore called and said she'd left some film to be developed. We picked it up and got those pictures. Her housemate said she'd gone on a hike with the guy. What's going on?
You don't know where this is?
No, it's just woods.
I'll tell you what, Terry.
I may be going crazy, but I think these pictures were taken at the same spot that Aronson's body was found. There's something about the way the hill sits, the trees. I may be fucked up.
Oh, brother. I never went down to the site.
Think about this. If you're a killer, and if you find one good spot, why go looking for another one?
A graveyard,
Marshall said. That's what I'm thinking.
You gonna look?
I'll get something started as soon as I get in tomorrow.
I'm coming up.
No point in coming up tomorrow. I'll have to talk to the sheriff down in Goodhue and get some technical guys together. I don't see us getting down there until the day after tomorrow at the earliest.
I'll be there. Jesus. Why didn't I look at that site? I looked at everything else.
It's your file, man. Never would have come up without your file. Weather left early the next morning, as she always did, driving out through a cold rain. When she was gone, Lucas cleaned up, got in the Tahoe, and drove south out of town to the hill where Aronson had been found. He walked the hillside in his rain suit, stood for a long time looking at the hole where Aronson had been found, but could find nothing else about the hillside distinctive enough to be sure.
Feels right, though, he said to himself. Graveyard?
He felt a chill and kept moving. Downtown, Anthony Carr, Ware's computer programmer, came by and took a look at the drawings.
I see so much of this shit that I can't remember what goes with who. All of it looks familiar.
We have an art expert who says the drawings are probably made from projected images, Marcy said. So the bodies would be exactly like the drawings. We'd like you to check around, see if you can match any of them. Carr shrugged.
All right, I'll look, but there got to be hundreds of thousands of them.
When he was gone, Lucas turned to Marcy. Kid ever call back?
He did.
We agreed that it might not be a bad idea to have dinner sometime.
So it's a little indefinite?
If you want a call getting picked up at 7 o'clock tonight, indefinite.
Lucas talked to the Goodhue County Sheriff. When he'd set up a rendezvous by the Aronson gravesite, Lucas called around until he found an engineering consultant who used ground-penetrating radar to look for pipelines, missing utilities, old cemeteries, and ancient campgrounds. The guy's name was Larry Lake, and he ran a three-man company called Archaeo Survey Incorporated.
Last time I worked for you guys, it took 2 months to get paid, Lake said. I had to threaten to have your patrol cars attached.
That's because you didn't find anything and nobody wanted to be blamed for the bill. It was a pretty big bill. I'm a certified civil engineer, not a burger flipper. If I bring $20,000 worth of equipment out in the rain, I need to get paid. I promise you, you'll get the money in a week. If it pans out, of course, you'll be famous. Probably get on one of those forensic TV shows. You think?
It could happen.
That evening, Weather showed up with a big black leather Coach travel bag for her sixth consecutive sleepover. Lucas dropped the Wall Street Journal on the floor next to his chair.
I figured it out. You hate me, and you're trying to fuck me to death.
In your dreams. The fact is, I'm going to get pregnant.
You volunteered.
The second fact is, I'm right around my fertile period, and I'm trying to blanket it.
Blanket it?
Yes. So, if you don't mind, bring yourself back to the bedroom. It'll all be over in a few minutes. The rain continued overnight. Weather left early as usual, and Lucas got another hour of sleep before he climbed out of bed, cleaned up, and rolled out of the driveway in his Tahoe. Dell was waiting in his driveway, under the eaves of the garage, already dressed in a rain suit. His wife stood beside him.
You guys be careful. The roads are slippery. Get some decent lunch somewhere. Eat something with vegetables.
In the truck, Dell said.
Jesus Christ, vegetables.
The drive to South Dakota County took 45 minutes, a slow trip against rush traffic. When they arrived, they found a green Subaru Forester parked on the shoulder of the road with a door sign that said Archaeo Survey, Inc. Just beyond were three sheriff's cars and a battered Jeep Cherokee. A half dozen men in slickers turned to look at them as they pulled off the road.
Cop convention, Dell grunted.
Lucas parked, got out of the truck, walked around to the back, lifted the hatch, found his rain suit, and pulled it on.
Then they walked down the road to introduce themselves to the others.
"Don Hammond, chief deputy down here," said the largest of the cops. "These guys are Rick and Dave. You know Terry Marshall?"
Marshall nodded at Lucas.
Hammond continued, "The sheriff will stop out later. He sure picked a good morning for it."
They all looked up at the sky, then Lucas asked, "Where's the radar guy?"
"He's up in the woods with his helper."
"Larry Lake?" Lucas asked. He was struggling up the steep hillside, slipping on the oak leaves, Dell, Hammond, and Marshall trailing behind.
"That's me."
Lake was a lanky man with an uncontrolled beard and aviator-style glasses. He wore a red rain suit. He was standing beside a yellow metal box on a tripod, which was set up over Aronson's grave.
"Are you Davenport?"
"Yeah."
"I better get paid. This is miserable."
"Yeah, yeah, yeah. How long is it going to take?"
"I got my guy over there setting up the last of the reference pins, so we'll start the survey in 10 minutes or so. I'm going to get a cup of coffee first."
"How long is it going to take after that?"
Lake shrugged. "Depends on how much you want surveyed. We could show you some of it in a couple of hours. We're using this grave as a center point."
He touched his ear, and Lucas realized that what looked like a plastic tab near his mouth was actually a microphone.
"Yeah, Bill, the cops came up just a sec."
To Lucas and the others, "This'll take a second, then we'll go get some coffee." He looked through the lens on the survey instrument, sideways across the hill to where Bill was holding a red and white survey rod with a knob on top. Lake said,
"2 inches back, 1/2 inch right."
"You're good. Put in a pin."
"Yeah, down at the truck."
At the truck, Lake's assistant got a gallon thermos out of the Subaru and started pouring coffee into paper cups, as Lake explained what he'd been doing. "We set up 4 control points around the center, which is at Aronson's grave, so we've got a big rectangle laid out on the hillside. The next thing is, we stretch lines from the pins at the top of the hill to the pins at the bottom. Those lines are marked at 1 meter intervals. Then we stretch another string across the hill, between the vertical lines as a guide. We'll walk back and forth with the radar along the string and move down the hill 1 meter with every sweep. We can probably get you a 50-meter square block in about 2 hours.
"If there's a grave, how do you find it later?" asked Dell.
"Our computer will actually generate a map to scale." The work was even more miserable than it looked. Lucas and Dell, alternating with Hammond and Marshall, stretched a long piece of yellow string between the corresponding 1 meter markers on the vertical strings of the survey box, so it resembled the letter H. The cross string had to go around trees, got caught in branches. Whenever it got tangled, whoever went to untangle it inevitably slipped on the sodden leaves and slid in the mud down the hill. When they'd run the last line, Lake said, "Let's throw the gear into the truck and run into town, find a cafe."
"How long will it take you to process?" Lucas asked.
"We'll dump the information into the computer on the way into town. We'll pull up some preliminary results right there." They went to the High Street Cafe in Cannon Falls, took over the round booth by the window, and dragged some chairs around the open side. Lake started the computer.
"Data looked pretty good going in," Lake muttered. "It's not like we came out dry."
"Can you actually see bodies?" asked Marshall.
"No, no, nothing like that. What we see are soil changes. They'll look like grave shapes."
"Trouble is," his assistant chipped in, "if a tree tipped over and its roots pulled up a hole in the ground, the radar will see it."
Lucas looked at the screen.
"Processing."
They all ordered pie and coffee, and Dell leaned over and said,
"Still processing."
"Takes a while," Lake said.
As he said it, the screen blinked.
"Processing complete." Lake pushed his pie away, pulled the laptop closer, tapped a few keys.
"There's Aronson's grave. That's the midpoint. Let's go up to the number one point and scan east."
They were all pressing in behind Lake now, watching the screen, which was showing a flat field composed of various shades of gray. The possible graves showed up as a darker gray in the background. They scanned across the hillside, then back, and across again, moving down the field in 1 meter increments.
"That could be one," his assistant said. "Let's get the coordinates."
"Let's just scan the whole thing first," Lake said. "That looked like a tree hole to me."
There's one, Lucas said. Another tree hole. Two more scans, then Lake said, Uh-oh. Look at this. He was talking to his assistant. That looks artificial.
Just like a grave,
his assistant said. Let me get the coordinates on this one. Lake resumed scanning, stopping only a few meters further along.
There's another one.
Oh, no, wait, we're at 00.
What's that? Lucas asked.
That's the center point. That's Aronson.
So the first thing you thought maybe was a grave, that was on the same level?
Lake nodded.
Yep, 5 meters east.
God damn it, one of the cops said.
Marshall humped forward, pressing close to the computer.
A grave looks different from anything else?
Yeah, for some reason, people have always made them rectangular. You can pick them out by the squared corners.
Holy ducks, there's another one.
He found a third on the same line, a moment later, then scanned back and found the lower portions of the three possible graves.
Oh, look at this, Lake said a moment later.
We've got another one.
Look, it's right between two of the graves above, but one level down.
It's plotted out like a graveyard.
In the end, they found 24 anomalies, including all the tree holes and natural gullies.
6, Lake said, could be graves.
Better get the sheriff right now, Hammond said. If these things really are graves, it's going to be a bad day at Black Rock.
They went back to the hillside, and within 10 minutes, a half dozen more cars arrived. Sheriff's deputies were scattered around the hillside in yellow rain slickers, 4 or 5 of them with shovels. Lake used the total station to guide his assistant across the hillside with the reflector pole.
There, he called. You're standing on it.
Lucas stepped over to look. A couple of cops had come over bringing shovels.
Let us in there, one of them said.
He and the second cop began scraping at the surface.
Scrape it, don't dig down, Hammond said, standing off to the side.
Dig it real slow, Marshall said. Ain't no hurry now.
Less than 6 inches down, one of the cops said,
This is a hole.
Lucas peered into the muddy gap in the ground. He couldn't see anything but dirt.
I can feel it, the cop said. He looked at the other cop. Can you feel the edge of a hole?
Right there?
That's it.
Still scraping, they defined the hole.
That looks like nothing more than a grave, Marshall said to Lucas. Now there was nothing but the sound of shovels.
Wait.
One of the cops knelt in the hole.
Is that a rock?
He probed the soil with his fingers. A moment later, he came up with a white object.
What is it?
Lucas asked, squatting next to the hole.
Dell moved in beside him, and the cop handed the white thing to Lucas.
Lucas turned it in his hand.
Finger bone, Dell said.
Lucas looked up at Hammond. We better stop digging and get the state crime lab down here. We gotta excavate these things an inch at a time.
Oh, sweet Jesus. Sweet fucking Jesus.
The drizzle continued. The sheriff showed up and sent 2 deputies back into town to find some tarps to build tents over the supposed graves. Lake began working on a larger plot. The state crime people showed up at mid-afternoon. The officer in charge, Jack McGrady, had worked with Lucas on another case. Lucas had shown him the bone in an evidence bag. The question we all had, is it possible that it's not human? McGrady held the baggie up to the sky.
It's human. Can't tell you what era.
What do you mean, era?
Bones last a long time. This is kind of a pretty hillside with a view. Maybe you've turned up a settler graveyard just by coincidence.
I don't think so.
Neither do I.
Late in the afternoon, Lucas and Dell went back to the cafe and ate open-faced turkey sandwiches with mashed potatoes.
Mashed potatoes count as a vegetable?
Dell asked.
Not these. These are some kind of petroleum derivative.
They ate in silence for a moment.
If those are all graves up there, we got a busy little bee on our hands, Dell said.
They're all graves. I can feel it.
In your bones?
Not funny.
Okay, answer me this.
You know the chick whose picture got pasted up on the bridge across the river?
Yeah.
Why was she picked out? What'd she do to piss him off? Why was she treated different?
Lucas leaned back in his chair. Oh, shit, why didn't we think of that before? Something's gotta be going on there.
So we start pulling her apart. And maybe we check with the archdiocese and see if they had any priests who were art students.
At 6, Lucas called Weather from the site and told her that he wouldn't be home until very late.
Trying to avoid your obligations, huh? She asked.
Maybe I can get out of here a little earlier than that. The hill was lit by a half dozen sets of powerful lights. Each grave had been covered by a broad tarp, and 3 of the 6 graves were being excavated by 2-man teams. Progress was slow, with the excavation being done with small Marshalltown trowels. Along the road, 3 TV trucks were sitting in the rain. Lake came by just after dark and squatted next to Lucas.
We finished the next plot. There are 2 more spots that we're going to stake out as possibles, but they're not as clear as the others.
Good. 6 is enough.
The first grave, the one where the finger bone had been found, was the first to produce clothing, a polyester shirt that Marshall recognized as a brand sold at Walmart. McGrady, squatting next to the grave, looked up at Lucas and said,
"So it's not a settler site."
They went back to the command tent, and Lucas called Rose Marie to give her the news. He was just off the phone when one of the members of the excavation team called.
"Jack, we got a skull."
As Lucas and McGrady recrossed the hillside,
"And we got hair."
They got to the grave, and the guy in the hole touched the edge of the bone with his trowel.
"Looks like blonde hair."
Lucas said, "We need to get working on the IDs as quick as we can. I've got a name for you, and there's some dental stuff available on her. If her jaw's intact, I can give you a quick read tomorrow morning," McGrady said.
Dell went back into town and returned with a thermos full of coffee. Lucas was drinking a cup when he saw a large man in a camouflage rain suit join Marshall on the hillside. The two bent together, and the new man put his arm on Marshall's shoulder as they talked. Another Dunn County deputy, Lucas thought. At that moment, an anguished croak slashed across the hillside. Lucas saw the large man and Marshall on their knees next to the third grave.
"Jesus Christ," one of the deputies said. "What happened to them?"
Lucas had an idea. He was on his way across the hillside with Dell a step behind. As they stepped into the harsh glare of the light, Lucas looked into the hole and saw a piece of reddish cloth. Terry Marshall put one hand on the shoulder of the large man and pushed himself back onto his feet.
"It's Laura's shirt. We think it's the shirt she was wearing."
"It is,"
the large man sobbed. He had both hands to the sides of his head, as if he were holding it in place.
"We hoped. We hoped."
"Jack Winton, Laura's dad," Marshall said unapologetically.
Lucas was struck with a surge of anger.
"Why in the hell did you—"
"I couldn't keep him off. Didn't even try. He's family."
Marshall patted the big man on the shoulder again.
"Jack, come on. Let them do their work. Come on."
Weather was still awake, reading. "Guy called. A McGrady? He gave me a cell phone number. He said you should call him when you got back."
"All right."
Lucas dialed. McGrady answered on the first ring.
"You know that first skull we pulled out of the ground?"
"Yeah."
"It's definitely a female. And we found the hyoid. It's in 2 pieces, and the break looks like it happened at the time of death. It's not a new break."
"So she was strangled."
"I'll let the medical examiner figure it out, but I'd bet on it," McGrady said.
"Check the others if you find more."
"We're gonna find more. We got 2 more skulls coming up now."
Lucas called Rose Marie to fill her in. He told her about Marshall, and she said,
"You better keep an eye on him. Sounds like he might be a little bit of a loose cannon. Keep him out of trouble."
He repeated the story to Weather.
"You look forlorn.
You should have heard that guy. He sounded like somebody was torturing him."
"Breaking his heart," Weather said.
They stayed up talking, sat close together.
eventually found their way to the bedroom. Making a baby, Lucas thought later, is something you can do even after a day spent digging up a graveyard. Maybe even a good time to do it.